In the coming week, top U.S. and Russian officials talk arms control and Ukraine in Geneva. Americans mark 1 year since the U.S. Capitol riot, and the Consumer Electronics Show wraps in Las Vegas. It's January 6, 2022, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, first of all, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well, Bob.
We'll see how momentous this is compared to the last two. I'm not sure I have the stamina, if it is comparable, but we'll see what we do.
My fingers are crossed that 2022 will bring us more good news than bad news, Bob.
Looking forward to that, and looking forward to a year-end blog post from you, looking at all the positive things that happened in 2022. Well, in the coming week, a lot on the agenda with the U.S., Russia, as well as U.S., European allies. U.S. and Russian officials are going to sit down in Geneva. They're going to have bilateral talks followed by Russia-NATO talks on January 12th, and then a meeting on January 13th that involves Russia, the United States, and other members of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Jim, set the scene for us. Why are these talks taking place now?
Bob, there's certainly lots of diplomatic activity involving the West and Russia over the next week. And I should note that there's also a NATO foreign ministers meeting tomorrow. It's going to take place virtually. Their conversation likely will be dominated by what should be said at the meetings that are going to be held over the next week. Now, you ask why these meetings now. The technical answer for the bilateral U.S.-Russia talks is that they are part of the strategic security dialogue that Presidents Biden and Putin agreed to when they met last June in Geneva. And that's why the official agenda for the meeting, which is going to take place in Geneva starting, I think, on Sunday, includes discussions about weapons capabilities and arms control, important issues, obviously, in U.S.-Russian relations. But the main topic when American diplomats and Russian diplomats sit down in Geneva is going to be Ukraine. We've talked about this before the holiday break. The Russians have engaged in a military buildup near Ukraine. Kremlin has said this is part of routine military exercises. But given the size and nature of the units that the Russians have deployed, the United States and many of its allies in Europe view the military exercise as the potential prelude to an attack on Ukraine. Now, there's been a lot of tough talk exchanged over the past month between Moscow and Washington. Presidents Biden and Putin had two phone calls last month. Putin's demand essentially is that NATO back off, agree not to offer membership to former Soviet states, and to reduce military deployments in Eastern in Central Europe. In a sense, Putin really is trying to rewrite the security order that was created after the fall of the Soviet Union. And remember, he regards the collapse of the Soviet Union as the great geopolitical mistake of the 20th century. Biden's position, to the contrary, is that sovereign nations are free to choose whom they wish to ally with. And in these discussions, the big unknown obviously is Putin bluffing? And that is, does he view these talks as providing an off-ramp from the tensions that he has deliberately created? Or, in fact, does he intend to make good on his threat to use adequate military technical measures if he doesn't get his way? So there's an awful lot at stake in these meetings over the next week or so.
Jim, how much stock do you put in the argument that these talks and any subsequent talks are important for especially the U.S. and its allies to really lay out the record straight, to note what you just noted, which is that in the past 20 years, the sort of train has left the station. There are independent countries now that are making their own choices, and that, in fact, it is Russia that fears a democratic Ukraine rather than any sort of threat, existential or otherwise, coming from an array of NATO forces on its borders. Our colleague Steve Sestanovich wrote along those lines in a piece for our website a couple of weeks ago as well, that the U.S. has sort of let the narrative fall into Russia's hands, and they've been able to whip up this concern, and that's a sort of the lens through its reporting seems to be coming out on. But do you see it that way?
There are two separate issues here, Bob. One is the question of whether or not Washington has lost control of the narrative, or Washington has failed to frame this issue in a way that reflects the historical record. And then there's the question of what it is that will move President Putin. On the first question, yes, I think in many ways, Washington, not just the Biden administration, has allowed or created space for President Putin to present an alternative narrative of what happened, and that it's Russia that is being impinged upon or pressed from abroad. But I think, realistically, for these talks, they are not going to change President Putin's view of the issue, which is he regards the loss of the Soviet Empire as a mistake. And to an extent, he wants to rewrite history and to return us back to where we were 30 years ago, where Russia is more dominant in what it considers to be its neighborhood. And it is quite clear that Mr. Putin regards Ukraine as a threat because Ukraine is right next door. They share the ancient roots, the sort of common roots from which Russia and Ukraine and Belarus came from. And a Ukraine that succeeds is a threat to Russia. And I will just note that, you know, for Mr. Putin, this will be an interesting thing for the talks that are coming up over the next week or so, is that he has problems across his borders, right? We're talking about Ukraine right now, but he has problems that next door in Belarus, you have a president who won re-election through rigged means, who then triggered protests from a population that wants nothing to do with him. I'm thinking of Mr. Lukashenko. You go eastward, you get to Kazakhstan. I think we're going to talk about that in a little while, where another regime that is close to Moscow is showing some great stress, shall we say. And so, you know, Putin views the success of countries who become more democratic, more integrated into the West as a threat to his order at home. And so it's not really about we don't understand what happened in the 30 years between the fall of the Soviet Union and where we are today. It's about the nature of Putin's regime that is under threat, and that is what he's trying to protect.
Yeah. And so because of that, I think it does seem like, according to a lot of the commentary that I've seen and the analysis, we don't know what he's going to do, but he would like to walk away without a major incursion into Ukraine and you know, pocket a few wins in terms of some proclamations from NATO that it poses no threat to Russia, or something that can be a little bit face-saving, seems to be a win for Russia without the extraordinary step of a military invasion. But there are a lot of forces, by all accounts, arrayed on the Ukrainian border right now.
I should note, Bob, that may be how it plays out. We shall see. But for the Biden administration, there is a bigger issue here at play, which is China. And there are a number of people that are concerned that U.S. policy toward Russia is driving China and Russia closer together. And that in itself is a danger to broader U.S. strategic interests, because again, go back to the sort of job number one for the Biden administration, which is to counter China. If you take steps that bring Russia and China closer together, you're undermining that goal. So I think part of what the Biden administration is trying to do here is to find some way to counter the pressure against Ukraine without creating deeper irreparable damage in relations with Moscow, because we have other issues with the Kremlin that we need to work out. And so the question is, can you find a way to square that circle where you preserve the integrity of Ukraine, you preserve certainly at a formal level the notion that sovereign countries get to make the choices they wish to make, without having an irrevocable break with Russia? Can you find some way to put that relationship on a positive path? Now, I don't want to exaggerate here that somehow we're going to very quickly get to a point where there's bonhomie sort of governing the relationship. But it's also not in the United States' interest to have very high tensions with Russia. And so the question is, can you find some way to take this diplomatic crisis and turn it into an opportunity?
And one of those other issues you mentioned at the outset, which is arms control, where they are managing so far to kind of move forward with an arms control agenda, fairly modest at this point, but still in all, it's a crucial one in terms of creating stability and hopefully reducing nuclear stockpiles, which had been part of some momentum in the relationship previously.
Bobby made an excellent point, and this is where the real art of diplomacy comes in, which is understanding in any crisis situation, there may be opportunities for what we call win-win solutions, that you can reach an agreement that works for your adversary, the person across the table, but may also serve your interest as well. And I think, again, in the area of arms control, there's some possibility there for some negotiations that could leave both sides better off and perhaps give us that sort of positive turn of events that may make other positive turns of event possible.
Well noted. Jim, I want to turn our attention to a somber anniversary here in the U.S. As we are taping this podcast, the country is marking the one-year anniversary of the mob attack that breached the U.S. Capitol building. The rioters who led the insurrection were supporters of former President Donald Trump seeking to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Tomorrow actually marks the anniversary of Congress eventually certifying Biden's election win, though many in the Republican Party continue to dispute this. Jim, can you give us a sense about the resonance of that day at the Capitol 1 year later?
Bob, January 6th was one of the darker days in American history. It was the first time we saw a concerted effort to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power. Now, we've had presidential transitions during wartime. We've had transitions between presidents who detested each other. We've had presidential transitions after elections were lost and won by the narrowest of margins. We've had transitions after elections took place where the loser thought the election had been stolen from them. But until last year, power had always been handed over peacefully. Then it wasn't. But it's clear a year after January 6th that we as a country don't have a shared understanding of the meaning or reason for January 6th. It's obvious in the reams of the polling done and in the events being held today. Biden, the Democrats are marking the anniversary with speeches and events warning about threats to American democracy. Republicans are nowhere to be seen. None of this is what I would have predicted a year ago watching the scenes on TV of rioters swarming over the Capitol, or when I listened to Republican senators like Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham denouncing Donald Trump's actions, or even after seven Republican senators voted to impeach Donald Trump. But it's where we are today, and whether you want to call January 6th an insurrection, a coup, a riot, or some other term, what has happened is it has deepened our divisions rather than reminded us of what we should hold precious and dear. I mean, that is our very democratic traditions. And I think that deepening division weakens us both at home and abroad, and it is going to have continuing harmful consequences.
Jim, there's been a good deal of alarming and very thorough reporting regarding efforts being taken in state capitals around the country, especially in states that narrowly went for Joe Biden in the last election, that would put people in charge who are firm believers in what's been known as the big lie, that there was fraud that resulted in Donald Trump losing the election. Although, again, we should point out, there have been challenges that have made their way through federal courts that have been dismissed. There have been audits that have been done that have not found major fraud. There is no merit by any sort of accounting that we have seen so far to those charges, but they persist, and they persist in a large percentage, seemingly, of the Republican Party. But now we're hearing talk about perhaps clarifying or taking some steps regarding an 1887 law that would, at the very least, create more clarity on who certifies the results of an election. Do you see that as something that could become a focal point in the country going ahead?
Bob, there's a lot there in what you just said, and let me note, you're quite right. There's no evidence of large-scale systematic fraud. We've had recounts and reevaluations and audits and the rest. And it is concerning that in a number of states, we're seeing the passage of laws that further politicize electioneering and election counts, indeed giving legislatures in some states the ability to override the will of the voters, which is not something that the founders anticipated or would ever have endorsed. And I think, you know, that is the real danger in terms of the consequences of last year, of January 6th, this notion of the subversion and deepening politicization of the process of counting votes. That's the real danger, not in the more far-fetched conversations we hear about civil war and secession and things like that. I think that's still more in the realm of Hollywood fiction than in something you're likely to see happen. But democracies don't have to end with a bang or an explosion. They can end with a whimper. We have plenty of examples of that. A country you're familiar with from your earlier career days, Hungary, where we have seen Viktor Orban basically erode through legal means Hungary's democracy. The same thing could happen here in the United States. Obviously, when you talk about the erosion of voting rights here in the United States, it's a big issue. And the Democrats have a variety of proposals for doing that, which Republicans have been unwilling to sign on to. And a lot of that reflects partisan divisions as to who thinks which rules will benefit them. You know, Bob, that there's now some talk about redoing the Electoral Count Act of, I think it's 1887. Now, that is the law that governs the counting of the ballots, because the Constitution isn't precise about how that process should proceed. Now, the Electoral Count Act of 1887 came about a decade after one of the more controversial presidential elections in American history, the one in which Rutherford B. Hayes beat the Democrat Samuel Tilden. And there's a lot of controversy about how that decision was was made. And so Republicans in the last week or so have talked about their being open to perhaps bringing more clarity to the Electoral Count Act. Now, it's unclear what changes Republicans would be willing to make when they sat down. I think many Democrats would be willing to sit down and talk about revamping the Electoral Count Act so it eliminates the uncertainty or eliminates the argument that Trump supporters made that somehow the Vice President of the United States, in terms of counting certified ballots, had anything more than a ceremonial role. You may recall President Trump argued then, I think he argues today, that the Vice President has this ability to ignore what states have certified as their ballots. So I'm sure that Democrats would be happy to come to agreement on a revision that clarified that the Vice President's job is simply to count the ballots and to change some other elements of the act. But for Democrats, that's not enough. And they want to go back to this broader question of protecting voting rights, which they see as being eroded by a number of the steps being taken in many red states in the aftermath of the 2020 election.
You know, I would just note that, you know, your point about the divisiveness only intensifying, I think, is true. And I think you can't help but look at the media landscape as being a big part of that. And, you know, and whether or not this is a year that any sort of meaningful steps are taken in terms of the big tech companies that own the media platforms, how that could play a role, I think will be fascinating because, you know, more so than ever, there's these rival echo chambers and there's no sort of common ground for the two sides, although there's multiple sides, but let's say two main sides, to actually engage in any sort of discussions about electoral or any issues. You know, it just seems like more and more driving apart. And even though there seems to be a more of a minority on, let's say, the Republican side, it's a very vocal, powerful minority.
Well, it certainly is. And in politics, the squeaky wheel often gets the grease. And I do think you're right to point out a real danger we face and one we have not figured out how to handle. And that is the existence of these echo chambers. I visit lots of websites all across the political spectrum. And I would say that those that are on the conservative far right side are running articles today. They're sort of perpetuate the argument that the election was stolen, that what happened on January 6th was a false flag operation, that it really wasn't a riot and the rest. And again, if people only consume that kind of information, you can understand why it is we end up in a situation in which Americans have not just different, but exactly opposite views of events. And again, to go back to my opening point, we had this sort of stain on American democracy took place a year ago, and we have no common reading about why it happened and what it means. And that's trouble.
Just one more point on that. It extends crucially to the ongoing public health crisis that we have in terms of there being an inability to find common ground on how we can get the country opened up in a manageable way, schools open properly. You know, a playbook that everybody can come along with, or if they disagree, they can find some sort of platform to discuss it. It's become a shouting match about masks, about vaccinations, about testing, and so forth.
And you're right, Bob. What happens is the most highly motivated people, the extremes, are the ones who dominate the conversation and what Richard Nixon once called the silent majority, which I think to some extent still exists, gets ignored. Bob, let's switch topics and lift the mood in the process. I want to talk about this year's Consumer Electronics Show. It is held annually by the Consumer Technology Association. New computers, phones, televisions, drones, and even smart refrigerators are among the new technology that's slated to be featured in this year's show, which I should say is being held in Las Vegas. Can you tell us a bit more about what's happening at the trade show and perhaps some of the new products that are going to be rolled out and that we will instantly want to own ourselves?
Certainly. I mean, first, it's worth noting the fact of the show happening. There are some large tech companies that will not be present in person. That's the former Facebook, known as Meta now, or Amazon or Twitter, will not be there in person, according to the latest reports. And the event is playing out as we speak. Something like 75,000 attendees, 2,200 exhibitors. And as usual, as you indicated, all sorts of nifty ideas trotted out. We should note, the reason we talk about this show every year is that it's it's been the venue for really major announcements that have shaped and reshaped the way countries have functioned, the way societies have functioned. The first VCR, laser disc players, early home computers, compact disc players, all sorts of home games, Nintendo Advanced Video System. They all were introduced or had their main initial moment in the sun at the Consumer Electronics Show, Jim. And so this year, people are looking for sort of how it might capture the zeitgeist or might be shaping things going forward. You have what will be an interesting look at COVID technology or technology that could help in the battle against COVID is going to be anti-COVID technology by a company known as Lumix UV. And it's going to be a kind of a robotic disinfection technology that can be used at retail stores, gas stations, airport kiosks, and so forth. It uses high-powered LED lights to pass over a terminal system and what's said to be disinfect at a level comparable to Lysol or alcohol without, you know, risk of damaging any terminal by using liquids, for example, liquid disinfectants. So there's things like that. That's certainly a sign of the times, the anti-COVID tech. But there's also an ongoing fascination about electric vehicles. What's going to be interesting among the companies that are going to be watched closely that have already come out with some unveiling has been Sony. Sony's setting up a new arm called Sony Mobility. So used to be known for its music and sound technology. Sony is now getting into electric vehicles. There's going to be a lot of attention paid to the range that the newer generation of electric vehicles has. It's always been a sore point that, you know, that the charge is required after a few hundred miles. Well, some of the models being rolled out in Vegas are showing 600 plus miles before they need a charge. And that's going to be more and more an emphasis as you see an interest. It seems to be a steady interest in electric vehicles being rolled out. And then there's all sorts of augmented reality type tech and cloud technology and cryptocurrencies are making a play. And that's all I can really say about that, Jim. I tie myself in knots when I try to talk about non-fungible tokens and cryptocurrencies, but it's just suffice it to say that's kind of a new element that's gaining also a niche following that's going to grow at the Consumer Electronics Show.
Bob, it is absolutely remarkable how fast technology changes and how much it has changed our life. I mean, the fact is we're doing this podcast remotely. You're in your house. I'm in my house. We can do it over the internet. We have iPads and iPhones or the Android equivalents of it. I mean, I must say 20 years ago, I didn't have a cell phone. I was a late adopter. Now you can't pry the iPhone out of my hand. It's sort of an extension of me, the way technology just sort of has become ubiquitous. And I think that is actually fed into some of the problems we just talked about in terms of the world we live in, because it's an avenue by which to provide misinformation. But as you point out, with some of the new technologies can make our lives better. Just think if you can find something that actually can help curtail the COVID-19 pandemic and what have you. One thing you said, Bob, that sort of stuck with me is you mentioned laser discs, because sometimes you get technologies that come and then disappear because they've been superseded by new technologies. I still have floppy disks and little 3-inch discs and various hard drives that have been made or rendered obsolete. And on that score, I should note the big news of this week is that BlackBerry, which was once the device of choice among a certain slice of the American workforce, ceased to operate this week. I guess January 4th was the final day that BlackBerry as a device for communication operated. Now, the BlackBerry company is doing other things, but the good old-fashioned BlackBerry, which I have, I think, 3 or 4 sitting in my desk in the office, are dead and buried. So BlackBerry, I loved you. Rest in peace.
Jim, you raise a good point. It almost makes me think there should be a special show dedicated to expired or defunct tech. And what did we learn or what did we gain from them? You know, even thinking about like the early video cassette recorders, the tale of Betamax, that was actually considered the superior technology to VHS. And yet it lost out. It just didn't catch on with the public. And so there were those people, the early adopters who were sitting there with this, you know, sort of obsolete technology. Like you, Jim, I've got any number of tapes and other things that I can't play anymore. I remember back in my Radio Free Europe days that some of my colleagues actually went to the Consumer Electronics Show and the buzzword was digital audio tapes, DATs. Everybody's got to have them. That's the future. Let's do it. And plowed some money into that. And we all, you know, when was the last time you heard of a digital audio tape? But it's things like that are worth paying attention to because they could be dead ends while the shiny stuff moves ahead and captivates us. But I think it's, again, this show, given the state of the world and given the state of work now, like as you mentioned, we're doing this podcast remotely. The workplace has been able to carry on because of remote technologies that are just incredible and have helped defy some of the lockdown requirements of COVID, or maybe enable them too. But it's that double-edged sword of it's an enabler, but it's also a disruptor. here. And it's, again, it always generates endless fascination. And we have a lot more of these shows coming up.
Well, Bob, thank you for mentioning VHS, because you just reminded me that I have, I think, 6 or 7 cartons full of VHS tapes, and I have no device that will play a VHS tape. So someday I should give up those VHS tapes, but I can't let go of them. But anyway, I think this is the time, Bob, where we turn to the audience figure of the week. That's something our listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected Kazakhstan protest surge. What can you tell us about the protests in Kazakhstan, Bob?
Yeah, well, Jim, you teased us a little bit earlier, but and we should do our typical caveat that this is a moving story. But what has happened this week has been rather extraordinary for a country like Kazakhstan, which was under heavy central government control, authoritarian control for decades. And suddenly that all spilled over into major protests in the largest city, Almaty, but also in particularly in parts of western Kazakhstan, where you had, and this is a familiar type of trigger, you had the country lifting price controls on gasoline and liquefied petroleum gas, which is used heavily in vehicles in the country, basically doubled retail prices. That was a trigger for protests that I think struck at a lot of grievances that Kazakhs have had, especially in the West, but really as we see nationwide about standard of living problems, about official corruption. Kazakhstan's leadership, by many reports, has benefited from the country's vast natural resources and benefited personally in the family of
the long-time. That's a polite way of saying stolen, I believe.
Stolen. Yes, that's right. This is a country that until 2 years ago was under the official sway of Nursultan Nazarbayev, who had been in power for something like 3 decades. It actually, as he stepped away, he was still been seen as the power behind the scenes there. The capital city is actually named Nursultan, and he has been able to exercise power. What's happened in these protests has been the toppling of Nazarbayev statues, which is sort of unheard of for a country like Kazakhstan. And you also had the current president, President Tokayev, basically setting in place, replacing the government, replacing his cabinet, and also restoring the price controls. So you have had a response that seems to answer some of the immediate concerns of the public, but it's gone too far. You also have this element, Jim, according to the latest reporting, and we have to take it with a grain of salt because there's been an internet blackout across Kazakhstan for the last sort of 48 hours, but you have reporting that there are people, possibly clans or gangs, coming in and sort of taking advantage of the mayhem and doing looting, massive looting. There have been attacks at the main airport in Almaty, and looting of government offices and attacks on police as well. And at the same time, the government has called on an alliance of former Soviet states known by the acronym CSTO and led by Russia, although the current chair of that is an Armenian. But they are now either already have or are poised to send in forces to restore order. That has all sorts of overtones about, you know, Russia exercising its control in another country in its sphere of influence. We'll have to see how extensive that gets and how much what emerges from the reporting. Some of the reporting is very disturbing in terms of attacks on civilian protesters. There have also been reports coming out about attacks on police and deaths on both sides. So I don't believe we've mentioned Kazakhstan in this podcast before, Jim. And we are at an inflection point in this country now about whether or not it can tamp down the concerns, the seemingly genuine concerns about inequities and abuse of power, and whether or not there's going to be an extremely heavy-handed response to this, like we've seen in Belarus, for example, or even in Russia itself when they were protests in Russia in recent years. It's an unusual situation. It's a very important country in terms of its vast size. It's one of the largest countries by physical size in the world. It has a huge border with Russia. It's got an important trade relationship with China, part of the Belt and Road Initiative. And so we'll have to see how this plays out, Jim, but it's certainly something that took everybody by surprise and maybe shouldn't have.
Well, you're right, Bob, to say this is a fluid situation and that we don't have really good insight as to what's happening on the ground because of the internet shutdown by reason of the fact that there aren't a lot of Western reporters based in Kazakhstan on an ordinary workday. I think one of the big questions that people in Washington, D.C., particularly in the State Department, on the NSC staff, and I think over in the Defense Department are contemplating right now is how do the events in Kazakhstan play into the Kremlin's thinking about Ukraine? We began by talking about these upcoming meetings with the hope that diplomacy will lower tensions in or over Ukraine. Ukraine. And I think one of the big questions that people who get paid to worry about this are going to have to confront is, do the events in Kazakhstan increase the pressures on President Putin to find a way out of the situation in Ukraine, or is it going to encourage him to double down? And I think that's a conversation that is going to be happening this weekend in Washington in the halls of power.
Well put. And to your point before about its restive borders, I mean, you now have, so you have all these Russian forces at the Ukrainian border. You have Russian forces in two breakaway provinces of Georgia, which constitute about 20% of Georgian territory. There has always been a kind of a strong Russian-Kazakh relationship. We should note that Baikonur Cosmodrome, really crucial location for launching the Russian space program, for being a part of the Russian space program, is part of a partnership agreement between Russia and Kazakhstan. Nazarbayev, over the years, always maintained a sort of strong, stable relationship with Russia. And so does this further, you know, sort of concern the Kremlin such that it changes its calculus in Ukraine, or does it double down on its approach to its near abroad? And does it have the wherewithal to do so?
Yeah, well, there's a challenge for the Kremlin in terms of how far can you spread your resources, military, diplomatic, and intellectual. So we'll sort of see what the choices are that the Kremlin makes going forward. But again, the challenge in a situation like this for someone like Mr. Putin is he doesn't control all the dynamics. It's quite clear there's some very powerful dynamics taking place on the ground in Kazakhstan.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The Africa Cup of Nations takes place in Cameroon. In tennis, the Australian Open begins under the controversy involving the number one men's seed, and Japan marks the anniversary of the death of Emperor Hirohito.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.